I want to tell you about something I've used and I truly believe in. Replayer. It's a sideline camera built for youth sports. Just set it up, hit record, and it captures the entire game automatically. No chasing the ball, no holding your phone, just hands-free, stress-free recording. The in-game tagging is one of my favorite features. One tap, and you can mark a big goal, ankle-breaking moves, or a clutch tackle. Then pull those clips for later for review, highlights, or social media. And the live streaming's next level. A buddy of mine actually watched his son's game while flying cross country at 30,000 feet. That blew me away. If you're a parent or coach at the field every weekend, Replayer is a game changer. Head to replayer.com. That's Replayer.com. And I think you'll be amazed.
Hey, soccer friends. I just want to give a shout out to our partner, TeamPlayer. They are changing the game on how you find the perfect soccer team for your player. Parents, this means no more endless social media scrolling to find information on teams. With TeamPlayer, everything you need to know is just a few clicks away. It's simple, straightforward, and lets you find the best coach and team for your player without any of the usual headaches. And coaches, we all know how tough it can be to get your team noticed, but when you subscribe to one of Team Player's team plans, you instantly get access to set up an online team profile that allows you to reach more potential players and showcase what your team is all about. It's super easy and lets players and parents see why your team could be the right fit for them. And if you sign up using the promo code PITCH, you can try any team plan free for 1 month. So whether you're managing a team or searching for one, come on over to www.teamplayer.us. That is TeamPlayer.us. And come give Team Player a look.
Family-owned Soccer Innovation is your go-to source for top-quality equipment. Whether you're a player, a supportive family member, or a dedicated coach, they have everything you need to elevate your game. For players, their innovative equipment are designed to boost your skills and performance on the pitch. From their agility cones to their portable goals, they have you covered. And family members, they offer durable equipment that's built to last because we know your support is critical to your player. Coaches, trust me, they can provide the equipment you need to run effective training sessions and shape the next generation of soccer players. Visit Soccer Innovations at soccerinnovations.com to start elevating your game with them.
And if you use the code PITCH, PITCH, you can receive up to 10% off your next order.
Hello and welcome back to Chat by the Pitch. This is Ian Babcock, your host. This week I have Coach Lindsay. You might have seen her around on social media posting about her soccer journey. And if you've read it, you know what we're going to be talking about then. Her soccer journey is a beautiful story of not giving up, resilience. And I think every player needs to hear this story. This is a two-part series where we go on talking about gritness, which is her mental side coaching of the game, and I think this applies to everyone. I think hearing players' stories and how they persevere through their trials is awesome to hear because it gives motivation to our players to be better and be ready for the next phase of their play. So let's start this chat and head to the pitch.
My name is Lindsay Huey. I am the current founder for Gritness, which is a mental strength training program. I also coach youth soccer in California at the NL level. So I have a 2011s and a 2012s. I also run the college coordination there. And then I'm just a mom.
Love it. So you actually posted a while back about on your post about your soccer journey, and that's what really got me interested. And then we actually had a conversation. And so let's start off with your soccer journey. So where did you start playing soccer, or when did you start playing the game that we all love? And
in the hotbed of soccer, so California, we are very blessed here to have awesome weather. So we, unlike many people and places, get to play pretty much all year round. I started playing when I was 4 because my older brother was playing at the time. And I could tell you that the experience that I had is probably like how most people would describe their first love, which would be a person. Mine was not that. Mine was the ball. And I remember exactly where I was standing and exactly what I was doing. I was four. So I remember this whole where I was. I was standing in between trees. I was watching my brother and he was kicking the ball across the field and everybody was running. And it was boy soccer, so fighting and, you know, very theatrical at the same time. And so I thought, yep, that I'm going to do that. I'm going to fly in the air. I'm going to kick a ball. I'm going to slide tackle. I'm going to dribble to the goal. I'm going to block goal. And it was like this inner feeling that I really can't describe any other scenario in my life quite matching.
That's awesome.
So that's where it started. That's where the love grew. I played out here, AYSO, Spring Select, and all that stuff. And then around 10, I started playing more competitively and played club. We really had no idea what we were doing. We just followed along with whatever coaches were pursuing us or whatever other parents were saying we should do. We just did that. So coaches would come over and ask my parents, hey, can she play for us? And my parents would say, sure, if she wants to. And I was always down to do everything and anything soccer. So I always said, yeah, I want to play more. And so I wound up playing for the Blues, which is a nationally recognized club out here in California. And I played for them for 5 years. And then I left to San Diego Surf my last year. They were 7-time reigning national champions. So that was cool to be a part of that, which I think is a whole different episode on the ability to win at the highest level and the challenges behind that. There's only so many soccer teams in history who have been consecutive winners. So that was very awesome. And then I went on to play at the University of Portland for 4.5 years. And we were 2-time Division I national champions there, 2002 and then 2005. The 2005 team was very unique in that it had Megan Rapinoe on that team, Christine Sinclair on that team, Stephanie Lopez at the time, Angie Wozniak. There was a lot of very big personalities on the team. It was one of the only teams in history to go undefeated an entire season. So that was an incredible team to be a part of and to captain. And then I played for our youth national teams. I played on the 18s and was cut my first camp, which was an interesting experience. Then I came back and made the 21s and stayed on that team as an overage player for a couple of years. And then in 2005, I made the full team and got my first cap in Portugal. And then I retired. I decided one and done. I had given up so much of my life for the game. And a lot of things had changed in my career. I'd been through so many different challenges. And eventually, I think the icing on the cake for me was when our collegiate coach, who was like a dad to me, had passed away. I really needed to have just a break in my mind. And so I went on to do my master's in marriage and family therapy. And then, like lots of athletes do, came back to the game shortly thereafter. And I've been a jockey ever since.
So let's talk about you. What you talked about in your post was a lot about your overcoming trials. And so part of that's overcoming injuries, and that's what you were talked about. So let's start with that side of the game, because I feel everyone sees the game as, especially younger parents. I'm going to start off with my age group. My son's a U10 or 2014, U11 season, I guess is the way I describe it. My daughter is a 2017. And I know injuries derail players all the time. And parents that have younger kids that are not seasoned in this world of soccer don't experience that until their kids are slightly older. You do have those freak incidents that happens at the younger ages. But I listen to a lot of my friends that are older, and their kids go through these cycles where they have minor injuries and they're out for 2 months. And that's huge in this game, because 2 months put you behind, especially at the competitive level. So how do you view your injuries and overcoming them, and to make the cap and to play at that high level, to your transition to that journey, how did you figure out to do it? I know it all comes from picking yourself up and doing it and your support system around you, but a lot of it's mental.
I think that some would say that the game is 90% mental and 10% physical. And I think when we talk about adversities, there's a lot of different kinds of adversities. Injuries is just one subcategory of an adversity. And so if we're speaking specific to injury, we even have to go further and delineate whether we're talking about medical or strictly physical. I had both. I had found out my junior year of high school that I had Graves' disease. So that's a thyroid condition that has to be managed with endocrinology. And I took off to college managing that on my own. So that was one very big injury that I had to manage, was being very disciplined and making sure that I got my blood drawn every 5 weeks, saw the endocrinologist every 6 weeks, was adhering to taking medications and following medical directives, which eventually resulted in a radioactive iodine treatment that I did up there by myself as a freshman, going to be sophomore. And so that level of discipline is already very unique to a young person. But when you talk about a young athlete who's been immersed in the game, that level of discipline can be very natural, very innate, if you're that 1%, right? I think that one thing I'm frequently reminded of with the people around me in my life is that I am not the average. I am the kind of exception, so to speak. And so the way that I handle things is not always the way that other people would handle things. I'm very proactive, very organized in how and meticulous in how I'm going to approach a goal. It's interesting that I can be very organized in this discipline and very disorganized in others. I just spent 25 minutes looking for my keys again at 41 years old. It's just so crazy. You love something so much, you take care of it so deeply. But when you just approach things with this whatever attitude, then you get these whatever results. So the Graves' disease was interesting to manage in that I didn't totally understand what it really even was. So that part of it was just becoming more educated in the area and how it would impact my fatigue, my recovery, eating habits, nutrition, and all that. And really, I have to say that it didn't, and I don't see all that it impacted my gaming a whole lot, but how would I know? Because that's all I knew. You know what I mean? So I'm not real sure, aside from the discipline, what all it really did to me or to my body. I'm fine now. I've been in remission for years since that radioactive iodine treatment. I'd been stellar at not getting breaks, which I think had a lot to do with having older siblings and doing a lot of, I don't want to call it jujitsu, but me and my brother wrestled a lot. And I was like the youngest brother, just like trapped in this little girl, long hair, big poofy hair. But my behaviorisms and all the things that I enjoyed doing was always with the boys. So I played football on the street. I played street hockey. I played basketball. And I'll tell you that had a lot to do with my athletic success. Basketball trained my peripheral vision to always be up and to use that side of my gaming. So I never had to look at a pass. I could just know somebody was in that space from having played so much basketball. My hand-eye coordination was extremely advanced because I played street hockey. So, and I rollerbladed while I was doing it. So all those pieces together, if you're going to have fun and be successful, go hand in hand. Otherwise, spend most of your time on the ground. And that's not very fun. So if you want to keep up with your older brother, you have to do older brother type things. And so that really kept me injury free. I know we as coaches consistently tell our athletes that they need to be focused solely on one sport. I personally do not believe in or adhere to that because a lot of the sports can contribute to another sport. Soccer is a fitness-based sport. So a lot of coaches love soccer players because we can run for days usually. I didn't have very many breaks because I did all these other things. I broke my thumb one time. but I usually used to tuck and roll. And I see so many of my athletes break fingers because they put their hands down. I never did that. I would always roll into the fall. So I was able to avoid those kind of injuries that would be setbacks. I tore my MCL my junior year of high school going into my senior year. And that was probably the biggest injury that I had experienced at the time. And that it did not require surgery. So I took something like six. Oh, it did require surgery, actually. I was one of the few who required surgery. It took 6 weeks for it to heal, which mentally they had told me I would be back relatively quickly. And I was not. I was out for about 4 months, which I was not used to. And so in that time, I basically just did only the PT that they had prescribed. I didn't do anything else outside of that. And I went to college and tore my meniscus, opposite knee, freshman year. That was pretty devastating because I was out of the state, away from home, and was supposed to be embarking on this big journey that now was halted. And that was mentally very emotionally draining and physically excruciating. Again, I was told it would be a short time off the field with a 4 to 6 week window. I was out for 6 months. And so after I felt sorry for myself for a day, the next day, I remember walking up to my window and being like, I can't even walk. How am I going to get back out there? I could see the training facility from my window. I was like, how am I going to get back out there and get back to this same place of gaming if I can't even walk to the window? So I had myself a day. I cried a lot, called home. And the next day I woke up and I was like, there's no way. I'm not going to let anything stop me. So I got down to the trainer. And I said, give me everything and anything you think to do so that when I come back, I'm stronger than I was before I went out. And so every time I hit that therapy table, I thought to myself, I'm going to train harder than every other person in this training facility, in this rehab. And so if this guy tells me to do 10, I'm going to do 12. If he tells me 75%, I'm going to do 90%. If he tells me 90, I'm going to go 150. And that's how I trained in my rehab. Was whatever they tell me to do, I'm going to make sure that I do it at 150% to the T, and I'll do more than what I need to. And so I spent a lot of time rehabbing, and then I gave myself extra core strengthening. And then I would go in there and I would run on my own once I was cleared to do that. And I always checked with the trainer. Do you think this is going to be too much? Do you think this is going to be not enough? And if they gave me the green light, it was on and popping for me. So that's how I dealt with the injury side of it was, you know what? I have to be competitive still. That part of me needn't die just because I'm off the field. How else can I compete? So I competed sometimes just against myself. If I was the only one in the training room, it was, can I go harder today than I went yesterday? Can I be more intense today than I was an hour ago? Can I get in one more time with the trainer before dinner? Will I be the first one here tomorrow? It's a very Kobe Mamba mentality type of behavior. So I think with the intensity that I pursued it that year, which would have been my redshirt freshman year, I was freshman of the year.
My God. I have three pages of notes. So looking at this now, you talk about there's more than just the adversity of the physical side, the mental side. So what other adversities did you challenge, go through? Changing clubs is one as a younger age, especially at your last year and going to the surf team. And then being a younger sibling, you always have adversity from being knocked around by them. What other adversities did you have to look through? Like the challenges? To me, there's the obvious ones. There's the genders, there's everything else. And how was there anything that stood out to you that allowed you to use as motivation or that you look back now and as a coach, as a player, see the game differently because of those adversities?
I think one of the obvious adversities is being away from home. I came from a single family unit at that time, and my mom had a heart attack at the same time that I was diagnosed with Graves' disease. So I knew when I committed to a school that I needed to be close enough to home that if there was an emergency, I could get home same day. So as a young athlete, I carried a little bit more responsibilities and maturity than most did. I had to keep in the back of my mind, you know, that although I was away from home, I still needed to be semi-focused on what was going on at home. And that's a pretty big adversity, leaving the nest, trying to acclimate to the academics. Most of my life, I've had ADHD and never been diagnosed or medicated. So, and a lot of things make sense to me in terms of why soccer has been this race of ease for me. The game is consistently changing all of the time, and an ADHD brain loves that. We love lots and lots of movement and changing and up and down and back and forth. It gives that ADHD mind a lot of exercise that it needs. Just, I wouldn't compare myself to an animal, but if I was going to make a comparison, it's like certain breeds of dogs need a job. And so my mind needed a job for many different things. And so when the game is consistently changing and maneuvering and needs a quick fix, and now you're on offense and then you're on defense and then you're building up and then you're breaking down, like, my brain loved those kinds of things. That was an adversity as well.
The ADHD, I don't think people really understand unless you actually have it. It is one of those few things where you can be doing six different things at the same time, listening to three different conversations, and be able to keep it all in focus. Then all of a sudden, you said to me before the interview started, you can't find your keys.
Even if interviews, I always have to remember the prompt to the question. Otherwise, I'm like, wait, what was I talking about?
I can relate 100% here.
Yeah, and there's a lot of athletes like myself who are undiagnosed and don't understand, like, why is this hard for me? Coach is standing in a group talking. I didn't hear a word you said because I'm busy looking at someone's ear or the hair on the back of their neck or whatever it is. I'm distracted constantly. So short and sweet is good for me. The visual is very good for me. And I didn't realize what a visual learner I was until I had to sit out that freshman year. And I was like a sponge. I sat, and instead of doing other things, I was like focused, laser focused on every word the coach said. I specifically listened to the things that he would get upset about and go, note to self, don't do that. Do not do that. Do not run into traffic. Do not play the opposite direction that you're facing. So I held those things in my mind. And I was like, if I'm going to sit on the sideline, I'm going to make the best use of this time. I'm going to learn everything I can. And so that's what I did. But it's an adversity, though, to be able to wake up and keep your day organized enough, not to forget what time training is, to be at the right place at the right time. For the average person, that's not even a thing. For me, it's a big thing. So there was those smaller adversities. Academically, I'm not the strongest, very street smart, but not super book smart. So that was part of the reason I chose to go to the University of Portland, was I knew that I would be in a smaller academic setting where I could receive help if I needed to. So that was part of it. I think you have the kind of social piece, right? It can be an adversity for some. My competitive spirit can often put me in my own social category where I don't really care if you like me or not. But the fact of the matter is, if I'm making a run and you hit me behind, we probably are not going to speak for the rest of the day. And that doesn't work well in a girl's world, because girls are very socially sensitive and they form these relationships that they want to nurture. And I did not have the ability at that time to do that. I was only competitive. And so that was an adversity, was how am I going to manage having these relationships that are meaningful to me and also competing at the highest level? And while I would love to say that I managed it well, in the 5 years that I was there, I did not manage it well. So that is an adversity. I didn't learn how to become better at that part of my game until I was an adult. And that was the whole reason why I came out of retirement, because I wound up coming out of retirement about 5 or 6 years ago, played for the LA Galaxy on the semi-pro team, of course, won a national championship with them too. And my whole goal in coming out of retirement was not for the soccer at all. It was to see if I could be a better teammate. And so that was my aim in coming back to the game, was if I had one regret, it's that I wasn't a very good teammate. I was a great competitor, but I was not a very good teammate. So if I come back to the game, can I heal that part of the player in me?
So after coming out of retirement, we've talked about your adversities you have. They have set you up for this point now. It sounds to shift your paradigm. That's, I think, as we get older, our paradigm shifts. And as a player, you see yourself transitioning and from the competitor to a teammate. And how was that for you? And I want to say as a mentally, because that's a huge change. Even watching young kids, you're talking 16, 17 year olds that are starting to learn to be a teammate versus I'm competing for every minute. If I learn to be a teammate, I'll actually might be on the pitch longer versus if I'm just super competitive, I might just knock myself out of being on a team. So as you're transitioning from this point, what do you see? Did you learn to be a better teammate coming out of retirement and viewing the game differently then?
I think I viewed my role differently. I didn't view the game differently. I viewed my role differently. I came with the intention solely to be positive, to encourage, to be in different scenarios where maybe I didn't start. And so could I soothe that part of the competitor in me and still be positive for other people, although very much wanting also the best for myself? I think part of my evolution was becoming a parent and trying to model for my kids. I can't throw a fit because I don't want them to throw a fit. And I want to be the kind of person, player, parent that is proud of my behaviors. And so I had a one-year-old at the time that was in the stands watching my every move. And then a two-year-old in the stands who was mostly watching her iPad. And then I had two older children at the same time. And they were young. They were very impressionable. And they watched mommy's behaviors. How did mommy prep? How did she train? How did she game? What was her attitude when in, when out? Kids see everything. They see all of it. So I'd bring them into the training room with me. Look at how I prepare my body when advanced. I would be there 2.5 hours before I needed to be. So I knew I had everything. I didn't leave anything behind, which for my ADHD brain could be a big challenge. But I'd have all my stuff prepped. In the morning, I would already be in a certain mind frame. So I would be showing them every step of the way. And then I would get the facility and I would tell them, you're going to come with me through the training room and then it's going to be game time and mommy's going to go out onto the field and I'm going to be the best version of myself. If it's to my teammates, to my team, to myself, whatever, I'm going to go out there. I'm going to do my best. And that's all anybody can ask of me, of you. And so the kids were very vocal. They were very vocal about whether or not I was sprinting my hardest and they held me accountable. As I could hear their little voices in the stand, it was a consistent reminder. I'm here really for them, not so much for me. I'm really here for them. I just get to enjoy being on the field and everything. And so, Nash, I totally approached it different. It was less about winning in the sense of result or outcome. It was more about winning in that role. And so I had a great, successful year after not having touched a ball in 15 years competitively. I wound up starting, I think I was honorable mention, my first or second week, scored a banger of an outside of the foot goal against Colorado at home. And those were cool moments, but I think what I remember most is the relationships I made with the players. Some of them have mentored for greatness. Jenna Nischwanger is one of them, who frequently and consistently gives her time to the business. And I've had several of those athletes come back for mentorship, which has been amazing to watch and see. I keep in touch with a lot of them. And so I know that my approach to be a better teammate worked because we're all still friends. I was able to have a social relationship that didn't kill the competitor in me. And I realized the two could coexist. They didn't need to be at war with one another.
So do you think if you would have learned that at a younger age, do you think your competitiveness would have changed at all? Let's say you learned it your senior year in high school. Do you think your trajectory as a player and your drive would land you even if you retired and got your cap and everything else stayed the same, do you still think you'd still want to be as much involved in the game as you are?
I don't know. That's hard to say. I think we can think that it would go a lot of different ways, but you don't know until you're in the moment. I think that I would have had a longer career, for sure. And I think that I would have had a lot of different experiences. Would I have been more successful? I don't think so, because the competitor in me was like 150% of whatever it could have been. But I think I would have had longevity in the game. I think I probably would have been more open to going international, to staying with the game a little bit longer. But I was mentally and emotionally exhausted. And that comes from the competitor being so intense and not being able to have any other balance is, I think, why that kind of just came to a head. And I was like, I can't do this sacrificing anymore. Because there was no balance. It was all soccer.
As a parent listening to what you're talking about, it's very hard. It's, and you probably see it more as a coach. You're also a parent, but as a coach, trying to teach your players those balances and trying to teach them how to keep the competitiveness in them, but also finding the balance so they don't hit a burnout stage. That's me as a parent. That's my biggest fear for my son. I will pick, but I don't pick on him on soccer. I only give him a hard time because he's past the age of me trying to tell him what he needs to do on the field, because he can outplay me because I have no soccer background. And I understand the game and how formations are played and movements. But only thing I harp on him is about his hustle. That's the only thing I can harp on him, because I can still out hustle him. Maybe 10, but I can outrun him and outwork him. And I will not give up. And that's the thing. It's like, how do you, as being as competitive, like you said, it's Kobe Bryant Mamba mentality, and that's a very rare, I would call it probably 0.25 of athletes actually have that mentality in the pro world. How do you navigate it then? And when you see it in players around you, you're playing with pro players, coaching, how do you foster it so they understand not to feel burnt out? But it may be at 18 or 22 or 21 then.
You goal set. And that's a large part of what I do in my business is you goal set. What is your end game? Okay, that we backwards chain it. These are the steps that have to happen in order to get here and stay there. And so you have to be true to your benchmarks. You set small benchmarks that are very specific, and then you build on those benchmarks until you get to the end goal. And when you get to the end goal, you have to have some kind of reprieve, some kind of break. And then you figure out, how do I stay here? And you benchmark forward. It has to be the player's journey. They have to be the driver. But as a support person, coach or parent, two very different roles, you have to be very cautious about how you navigate that space. And every player is going to be different. Some kids want a game 7 days a week. That can be done for a period of time, but every body, physical body, needs a break. And one of the main things that, I think his name was him, was Kobe Bryant had a trainer. Can I remember for the life?
Oh, he wrote a book, didn't he?
Relentless. He wrote Relentless. He's yes. Very famous. I'll have to find it in Sky.
But I know he's I read his, I listen to audiobooks. I'm dyslexic and ADHD, so I feel your pain with ADHD.
Yeah, he has that book, Relentless. The heck is his name? Anyways, he said one of the reasons that Kobe was so successful was because of his determination. But the reason why he stayed that way was this guy's ability to create that break, that he was one of the people who needed to be taught how and when to break. That if it was up to him, Tim Grover, that was his name, Tim Grover. Tim Grover said, I had to teach him how to step away, not to put in more work, but to step away. And so there is that. I know there's lots of parents who have their kids doing 85 games a season and playing with this team and playing with that team. And sometimes it's necessary to say your body needs a break. And I have a team, 2011s, at the NL level that I have coached for the past 6 years. And that team has, of course, changed in its makeup this last 2 seasons and that we went NL, had the same group. And we were very systematic in what we did, extremely. And so we started at flight three, and we played flight three, just getting down the basics and the foundation. And we went flight two, and we won state cup. Then we went flight one, and we were successful. And then we went to NL. I had 100% retention on that team. I had 100% retention for 4 years until we went NL. When we went NL, of course, the makeup of the team changed, and a lot of people were angry because they thought that they should have made that team and whatever. But this past season, after having had them for, this is going on my 6th year, I said, for the month of June, we're off. Oh, the looks on these kids' faces and the jaw dropping from the parents was like, almost, they were like insulted. Why would you give us a whole month off? What are we going to do? We're all going to shrivel up and die. And I said, we've been going hard for 6 years. We have not taken a break. We've had a week in Thanksgiving, 2 weeks off in December, and we perpetually game, game, and game. Not only does your body need a break, your mind needs a break, and coach needs a break. We're not going to be healthy coming back from this if we don't take that break. We took the break. I think for some, it was not a break. I believe that they trained on their own. But that was still a break from what we do as a unit. And it was necessary. We came off that break, okay? And we had 3 broken feet. We had 1 girl with her national team. And so our first tournament back was Surf Cup, which is a nationally recognized event. We got bumped down from best of the best, even though nationally we're top 30. And so we were, this is like yucky. But then we had all these injuries and whatnot. And so we played with 11 players on Friday. 11 is all we had after coming off this huge break, right? Saturday, Sunday, Monday, we played with 12. And we borrowed a player from one of our sister teams, the 2 levels below ours. We don't do what some of the other California clubs do, flying in all these kids from all these different directions.
What? No way.
To win at all costs, we didn't do that. And we freaking won Surf Cup.
Awesome.
And off of a break with 11 players, 12 kids for the remainder of the time, hardly any subs, 1 kid played sick. That is mental warfare. These kids, I tell all my players, boy, it might be a hard thing to play for me, but you will be ready for the military. You Navy SEAL tomorrow. And you know how hard it is to do that? Not everybody can do that. But you play for me, you're going to be ready for the Navy SEALs. It's very militant. And there's a part of that coaching that works for a certain breed of player. And there's a part of that coaching that will never work for a certain breed of player. As a coach, I am very forward. This is my coaching personality. This is my philosophy. This is what I do. If you're this kind of player, you will not work well in this system. And as a favor to you and to me, I have to say this is not going to be a good fit. I'm just super transparent about it.
I don't know if you listened to any of the episodes I have had, but my favorite quote I was given from Jeff Jin, and he actually went on another podcast and talked about it. Excuse me, sorry about that. Was coaches are the best well-intended liars. And to find coaches that are honest, forthright, and sticking to their guns. And it's very uncommon. I'll say, being living in North Texas, I have came across maybe a handful of coaches that I can honestly say that have always been honest and truthful to me. Some of it, as a parent, it's hard to hearing, but it's made our friendship better. It's someone I go to on a regular basis for advice. When they told me, like, your son, this is their problem. They'll never be successful until they overcome this. I'm like, you're mean, but he's 7. But at the same time, me as a parent, I realized, no, just being honest. He's not being mean. He's being honest. And he goes, if you want him to work on it, go work with this individual. And sure enough, I took the advice and my son has overcome some of those challenges. And it's interesting because you don't get that transparency because you have a roster to fill.
You don't get that transparency because oftentimes when we're transparent as coaches with parents, they fly off the handle. They become extremely aggressive and hostile. And then they become extremely vindictive. And they will twist and turn and change things. And I had not had that experience for quite some time up until more recent. And it will force good coaches out of the game. It will force great coaches who are excellent people and have good intentions and care about your kids. Just because we don't go about it the same way that you would go about it or somebody else goes about it doesn't make us wrong or malintentioned. There's just everybody has a different personality and a way of doing things. And as long as it's not malicious, as long as it's not harmful, which is extremely subjective, then I say, you know what? Always try to be a person who's evolving and say, is there any truth to this? Number one. Number two, is it with good intention? Or there's a lot of coaches who give us bad reps and they do lie and they are amazing salespeople and they have no intention of actually doing what they say. And so it's a very kind of sticky industry. For one, it's very unregulated as well, right? Anybody can essentially get their license and then there's no accountability in how are you developing these players? What is your system? Do you have a system? What's your plan? What's your end game? And then there's getting into a competitive arena where everything is based on results. And so a frequent complaint that you'll hear from parents is they're not developing my player. The unfortunate part is sometimes we don't have a whole lot of time to develop because we have to get the result.
Right.
So
and this is
we're going to be result-based. We compromise sometimes the development. If we're going to be developmental, then we often have to ignore the result. And that's why at the youngest ages, they should not be keeping score. It doesn't matter what the score is. It does not matter what the score is.
Yeah, I agree. You're hitting me on like you're giving me goosebumps here because this is the message I've been getting for a year. And at what age does that transition? And I think that's where parents get frustrated. I heard from a coach here when they got advice from, I'll say it, from Villarreal here, got advice from Villarreal in Spain. They told them not to play with the ball for practices at times. Let them learn how to move their body at young ages because they don't know how to move their body. And the response is, our parents would go nuts. And I get it. And it's not the right coach. It's not the right club for your family then. And this is where me as an individual, I have grown and understood. And I still have goosebumps from what you're saying because it is the foundation's so important. So when you're looking at this as balancing the two, I always say a good coach has a 500 record. And that's my opinion, close to a 500 record. Might be 400, might be 600, but a great coach will have a 500 record. I'm not saying leagues or tournaments, in my opinion, and the reason why is they're in the right place for them to grow. They aren't getting slaughtered every weekend, and they aren't just steamrolling everyone. And they found the place for competitiveness. And so how do you view, and that's my opinion just because conversations I have, do you think that's correct so you can build that growth level? Because if you're always winning, there's no room for, I don't think, true growth. And if you're always losing, it disparages kids from playing at any age. I don't care if you're 6 or 20. Kids keep track of scores. As parents, most of the time now, I'm asking, like, what's the final score of the game? Because I don't keep track anymore because are they doing the 1-2s? That's what I'm focusing on now. And my son's 10. And I'm more focused on if they're doing the 1-2s correctly or the giving goes. And I think my mentality has changed. But where do you think that line has to be drawn?
I'd say that the competitiveness of it, that keeping score should probably not start until high school. I think that's when it becomes a little bit more prevalent that you need to have indicated some sort of success by that time so that recruiters know at what level are they seeing in a team. And so that's my personal opinion is that high school age becomes more focused on results and how you obtain those results. But realistically, we could go as far as saying, if you're not getting paid, like, what is the result? Like, what does it really matter? So I think it has to be high school. You can't wait till you go pro, because some people are not going to. And so high school to me seems like developmentally, mentally, so psychosocial, that piece is appropriate. I think players have had long enough in the game to learn, hopefully, the game and have been developed. And now it's time to teach the other side of the game, which is you're developed enough. Now you have to seek result. You have to seek reward. I think if we taught players other ways of being successful, all of the pressure wouldn't fall solely on the wins and the losses. And so what I do with my kids, because we use Huddle, we look at pass attempts. Did we pass over 250? Did we pass over 300? Of that pass attempt, how many did we actually connect? What was our highest strength combination? 4, 5, that's not great. Let's try to be above 7 on a consistent basis, that we are consistently stringing together at least 7 passes and obtaining more possession than the opponent, that our possession is higher up the field. So I wouldn't agree that 500 is like a good place to be. I would say that just like a player, a coach has to have an end goal, and they need to have benchmarks, and they need to make what they're trying to do very clear and obvious to their team. And just like they're communicating to the team the goals, the goal for the coach needs to be communicated to the team. And when you work cohesively, then it can work. This year, I said to my players, because you have to be in a constant state of evolving. Just because I'm militant doesn't mean that's the only way to be, you know? So I have to continue to evolve and grow as a coach as well. And so I said, this year, I'm going to hold myself accountable for not giving direct feedback during the game to a player. I'm going to hold the feedback, and I'm going to make more like line directives. So I will direct a line, defensive line, a midfield line, the strikers. Those instructions I will give for organizational purposes. But at chess time, I can meet with players separately so they don't feel like, oh my, they're getting called out. And then in the trainings, that's where I'm going to go in and individually say, let's rewind this. What were you thinking? Why did you make that decision? What were you processing? Help me understand what you were thinking so I can help you understand not to do that again. How we got there, we need to figure out how we get somewhere else. And so I check in with the girls. Hey, did it feel different this time to you? Did it feel like it was more positional, less individual? And so I think that makes a good coach, is a coach who's willing to make adjustments for the good of the group. For the good of the group, not for the good of the parents. That's different. Right. That's different. For the good of the group. Is this making the group more successful? Is this achieving the goal at hand? And so that's my goal this year, is can I coach more intensely in the training so that when they get to the gaming, it's a little bit more free.
Hey, everyone. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode with Coach Lindsay. She is a phenomenal resource to have if you're looking for something to help your players. Her story is so inspirational. Not giving up, having that gritness to continue, then coming back and playing the game again. I think that's so phenomenal. But there's so much more next week in next week's episode, so I hope you stick around and listen to that episode. Hey everyone, if you guys have enjoyed this podcast, have enjoyed what I've been trying to do, the messages that I'm putting out there, please give me some ratings, some stars on all the podcast sites that you listen to this on. Give me a review, share this, share with others. The more I can make this grow, the more I can continue doing this. I'm really trying to make a difference in our soccer community. So I hope you guys have enjoyed all this. And until next time, I'll see you at the pitch.